And welcome to the Dice is Screaming Podcast. Oh, yeah. Wow. Hey, I'm Randy.
I'm Mike.
And we're in business. So, yeah, bringing another podcast to you. This week, we're going to be talking about anime, manga, and the gamer. A love story.
Yeah, as promised, exactly as we said last week, that is this week's topic and discussion. We're right on par.
And hey, this isn't going to be a weeb love tour. We promise that this is actually going to be, if you grew up in the 80s, you will recognize what we're talking about.
Yeah, any person who has a familiarity with the products that were beginning to reach American shores in the 1970s and 1980s is going to recognize a lot of the names here. And whether a great many of us were not fans of all of these, okay?
Yeah.
But most of us at some point or another brushed up against one of them. Why? Because the gamer experience was an intersectional thing with fantasy fiction, science fiction, movies, television,
comics,
and of course, print medium, books, and comics. And along with that visual,
it's like
media,
a Venn diagram.
Yeah. Along with that visual experience that was included in films and television shows, one of the things that began to emerge in the United States was animated products. So we're going to break that down in our main section. So look forward.
Yeah. We got a couple other things to do.
We got a little intro discussions to have.
Yeah, about our past podcast. Yeah. Discord, Rumbles aside. No, we're not on Rumble, but we are on Discord. So I do hear things, tremors in the earth, rumors,
whispers in the walls,
but yes,
toys in the attic.
We had some discussion about our last podcast, how they're like, oh, we seem to be going after some of the people that make the doom and gloom, living off the clickbait. And I think me and Mike covered that pretty well. Mike, especially, you landed exactly where I wanted to do. You stole any talking points I had from underneath me, but hey, you know, that's what we do here.
Thank you. You can expect no less from the random pickpocket of gaming podcasts.
I needed that potion of healing.
I'm sure I had it somewhere. Yes, I have been known to do that.
Yeah.
I have rummaged through the change of gaming podcasting.
That's what we do here. Okay, we steal things. We're thieves.
Great DMs, do not borrow.
We steal. So we steal from each other too, so don't feel too bad about that.
Yeah.
But definitely getting really tired of that whole, like, oh, everything's doom and gloom, the clickbait, like, this is the newest scandal. Yeah, really disappointed in you in Dungeons and Discourse. Just shameful. Tisk, tisk. I hate to be that look at you, but that last pod, or a little YouTube video she did about a scandal, it was... Wow. Outside of some scurrilous yellow journalism in, like, Bat Boy is running for president. Yeah, I have never been lied to like that. It's so obliquely and shamefacedly. Linking Ginny D and the rest into this, it's terrifying. We're sinking to that lows.
Yeah, look, I know that that's a moneymaker, though. You know, like, the more outrageous... the more controversy, like, you have to ask yourself, like, they know they're going into this not saying something that is accurate. They have to know that going in. Like, do they seem like they're sticking to their guns and their true believers? Perhaps. But a little part of me has to wonder, do they know full on right from the get-go that this isn't going to be true, but it's going to create so much controversy that...
The clickbait is going to...
Huge numbers of, like, retweets and reclicks and, you know, this is going to be linked in other people's discussions and, like the net
right
effect
now.
Is valuable. I don't like that kind of thing. I do like a lot of the, various gaming free agents who, you know, like, do topical discussion on things and genuinely strive to bring up new news and, not be too heavy-handed. Like, maybe they come down against something here and there, but they also come out swinging for things. You notice that little balance there. Yeah. They're not just riding the doom and gloom wave. And we may call a couple of people out here and there, but as far as, like, the usefulness of the genre of, like, gaming discussion, yeah. I like that they're out there. I like that there's a variety of people doing it. But there is some conduct that, like, if you see it, and it becomes consistently about that outrage clickbait, that's your warning shot.
Well, when you use other people that are only peripherally attached to your point of conversation, and you're just like, hey, you know, here's a picture of Genie D and another popular YouTube content creator that are in the background of my YouTube picture, and you spend all of 15 seconds talking about them, you're a clickbaiter. And I understand, hey, we're talking about you here, but in the same vein that we're going to call out Wizards of the Coast for making some bad stuff, some of you YouTubers need to clean your act up and learn a little bit about how to be honest. Now, look, that said, I would just like to land on this point, is that we're going to try to be a little bit better about how our content is. We have also delved a little bit into the negativity algorithm. But we try to be a little bit more topical. Hey, look, we're human. We make mistakes. We get carried away. We ramble on.
Oh, I do.
But we try our best to be topical and at least...
Just don't mention Ken Ralston again.
Yeah. We just did. We'll move on. No, but I would like to say that...
See how I left it there? Perfect gentleman.
There you go. You know what? Small steps. We appreciate it. That's where healing starts. I just like to say with the D&D release that here's my thing, is that they might not have had so many problems releasing the new edition on time and in a better fashion if they hadn't laid off a third of their staff. And maybe that's unfair. That's not really what's happening here. But you get me where the optics are, where they land on this is, you know, when you go sights on to the target, that's what you end up with, is you laid off a 30-year staff, and now you're having problems getting content out, okay? There's a relationship and causality here. Maybe they're not as straightforward as we make it, but that's what it appears as, and it's hard for you to move forward with that. But that said, we're going to move on to other things.
I personally think it's tactical in nature, and it's to spread the hype out through the holidays, you know? Mm-hmm. And I noticed that they picked that particular time of the year, you know, that it's going to be like pre-holiday, mid-holiday, and post-holiday. And I think it's tactical in nature, but I also think it's a crappy tactic. So,
yeah, it was topical to us.
But you'll notice that, you know, I will not characterize that as doom and gloom, end of the world, and I will never, ever touch anything they do again. I am watching. I'm, one, discussing them. Two, I'm discussing them because I'm probably going to pick up the physical product one after another when they are finally released. And I feel like I owe it almost to myself to have an actual look and measure it and weigh it on its own merits, much as I did with the 5th edition. The only edition I didn't do that for was 4th. And occasionally I feel a twinge of guilt because I bowed out completely and I had zero level of engagement, and it was very hard for me to understand.
But just like with the Ken Ralston, we were well on the record of establishing our 4E credentials.
I'm stating where I made the mistake there.
Well, I don't think it made a mistake as much as that's what you did.
I'm
not picking up anything from this.
But I've learned.
The reasons that I've stated before. And I have no interest.
It's not doom and gloom. I will hold them to account for the things that they have done, but I'm not going to let that just, unless they do something incredibly egregious. Like, I am always watchful, seeing like, what have you created?
Exactly.
What have you done for the
community? What have you done for me lately?
You created for this community lately? And is it impressive or not?
So, yeah, getting into that vein, I would like to say that, yes, we will be talking about a few things here and there. I, on the other hand, have a much different view, and that's well entrenched. So here, Vecna Eve of Ruin is getting a master treatment, and of course that's going to be a major thing, because that, to old schoolers, you know, your you're pushing all the right buttons here.
Yeah.
The nostalgia dopamine hits are heavy on this one. Yeah, Vecna, lore hidden right in the back of the original white box edition. I think it was, goodness gracious, I'm getting confused for a minute in my old age. Was it Greyhawk or Eldritch Wizardry? I believe it was Eldritch Wizardry that had the artifacts. Yeah, whichever of those two it was, the little booklets. Yeah, that was a part of it as well as the sort of costs. And you just had to wonder, like, who is Vecna?
Yeah,
what nefarious deeds are that only his hand and eye survive to this day? And that darn sword, you know, it's a lion piece of crap, but you know what? It's certainly handy. Plus six Hackmaster, dude. Yeah, there's a lot of things you can say about Vecna, Eve of Ruin coming to tabletops. And yeah, you know what? I approve. Whether or not I'm playing that current edition or really involved with it, that's a thing that I like to see. It warms the cockles of my old heart. So, other news going forward, too, is, yeah, we're going to fangirl for Paizo, but also Catalyst. Catalyst and Paizo are teaming up to make Runefire. Now, it's not what you think about a collectible card game. It's a deck-building game, which, if you're familiar with those, you have to pair through a large provided deck and build a quick, basically like 52-card selection that you're going to run through a situation. They did this for Crossfire, which was for Shadowrun. So I guess this is going to be some way adjacent to that, at least mechanic-wise, and possibly tied to some adventure path or something. Probably Rise of the Rune Lords, Curse of the Crimson Throne. Who knows? We don't know a whole lot yet. But it's been announced, so kind of excited about that.
Yeah, and at the time that like a greater level of information becomes available to us, there is likely to be an episode-level event to discuss the actual product and the nature of its like play style. Like, what are the mechanical aspects of this? You know, is this a fun... which I'm almost sure that to some degree it will be awesome.
Well, I played Crossfire in a release demo, and it was pretty fun. I mean, yeah. I'm not going to lie that deck building's not my main thing to do. But, you know, it's a non-collectible card game, and you don't have the FOMO. You don't have the, I got to collect everything to have here. Yep. You've got your good and bad cards, and you've got cards that you need in order to propel you through the mission.
Yeah, I've got a lovely little game called Fantasy Realms that's like largely forgotten, but it's just a little card game.
Oh yeah.
Okay, you know, I had a blast with that. Okay, I still dredge that one out from time to time because it's just fun.
Yeah, and also announced was Critical Role's Dagger Heart is now an open play test, and we're getting a look at that. Obviously, it's going to be a radical departure from what we thought. It definitely uses cards and two 12-sided dice. So. I mean, sure, I'm sure things will be changing as they show more of the playtest, but look, you got to sign up and get your materials, and then the rest is, as they say, up to you. But getting a sneak peek before its full release, you know what? I'm going to go sit and say it right now. I kind of feel like going forward, they may stick with D&D. With this. I think that they'll definitely develop it and play it, but just like their Candela Obscura Other Worlds game, they probably are going to use this to tell a different style of story and maybe a big departure if they want to go with this one. So you know what? Interesting times.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say is I'm kind of feeling like...
very curious as to where this is going to go. You know.
Yeah, where it leads for the show. So, and then finally, Tomb of Gaizengax from Luke Gygax and others. Yeah, here we go. I'm going to turn this one over to Mike. I've been running my mouth. So.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I got to hand it to them. Luke and company, they have been making games before. I want to clarify for a moment that this is not Ernie and Co., who are off in the wilderness, you know, out in the woods, up to no good, trying to make love to the badger. Luke and friends, on the other hand, have really focused on, like, can we just, like, make games that aren't, like, discreetly about being horrible to people? Can we just make stuff for gamers that's fun to play?
Luke with Gary Kahn.
Yeah. They have developed the Tomb of Gaiden Gax. And I got to say, this is looking good. I saw some of the promos and advertising. I went to the webpage and did some background research to see about like the comprehensive nature of it. And I'm going to say I'm not entirely dissatisfied with the price point.
No.
Which I'm usually like, yeah, people who are used to me know that like I couch my terms. I'm very cautious with my compliments. How do I put this? In that true Mike way, none of the things I examined triggered any of my negative responses. So that's as positive as I get. I looked and went, okay, this looks good.
This did not offend you. Okay, well, you know what? I think
I am a product of my father, which is like usually the highest praise was, hey, you didn't screw anything up here. Well done. And that is where I stand today. That is like his voice coming out of my mouth. Hey, Luke, you guys didn't screw any of this up. I like it. Good job, kid.
Yeah, I think this is high time for Ernie to return home.
Yeah, this is, to give it a quantity of classic literary mythology here. I feel like Ernie, is not I don't feel like Ernie's a terrible person per se. I know that he's been involved in the very, very foolish things, but I feel like this is a Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe moment where, like, you know, Lanasa rode up to him in a sled and offered him some Turkish delight, and at his darkest hour, he was just like, I guess they really like me. You know, I got Turkish delight, and I'm in a nice warm sled. Let's go. You need to go home, okay? You get back with Team Lion, because they are killing it. Like, this is real product. This is going to hit tables. This is going to hit shelves. This is what you should be doing with your life. And
yeah, Ernie talks about a legacy that he leaves, and it's not a really good one, but he's made it even worse by doing this. Where, look, Luke shook his hand a couple times. That's about it at Gen Con. You know, hey, Luke Hygax, I'm Randy Patton. Like, he totally wouldn't remember me at all. But maybe out of the fact that I've met him and, you know, it's like, this is a guy who really loves the community no matter what you play.
Yeah, he appears to still be a person who is engaged in gaming and creation of games and with a has
lot
fun.
He has a lot of fun at conventions, and that is apparent. He loves the legacy. And I imagine being in the Army Corps of Engineers as a major, and your dad was the one who made Dungeons & Dragons, and he's like, yeah, I know. And I imagine that's also given him a very thick skin, but also an ability to smile about it. Because you either get grumpy or you learn how to just smile.
Yeah.
So that's what struck me about the guy. So, yeah, Ernie, I mean, get away from my ass. He's a total tool.
You've been coaxed down this path by people who I'm sure were as complimentary as possible to you. You know, like the offer of being like, here, would you like some Turkish delight? Hey, those are not your friends. Okay. The guy with the candy bar and the panel van is not here to be an actual friend to you. Okay. That is not what they're there for. Okay. You have something they want, and this is not going to go well. And you fell for it. And you know what? Rather than judging you for that, I'm not saying, you know, like there's no way back. I'm saying that when you make a mistake, re-examine. Like, okay, you know, break it down, have a look at it, give some due consideration to, like, man, I could have done that better. You know, maybe there's a reason that this is not working out well. I'm just going to Dr. Phil that, you know, and just, hey, how's that working for you? You know, because it's not looking great from over here. Like the average watcher would conclude that this has not been your shiniest moment. So, hey, good for Luke. Tomb of Gaiden Gax on the way out. And I like what I'm seeing.
Nice. Yeah. So, yeah, that's about a roundup from around the gaming sphere. I mean, Vecna, Eve of Ruin does seem to be worth it.
I did want to make a tiny side note.
Oh, go ahead.
Referring back to one of our previous podcasts very recently, in our like Fantasy Cities moment, Dungeon Crawl Classics is, you know, pushing the release of their Lankmar.
Oh, yeah,
which we spoke of Lankmar. And, you know, those who are wired into what constitutes a great fantasy city role-playing environment, they always come back to Lankmar. That is why we spoke of it with such respect and awe. It is one of the great settings. Mm-hmm. And behold, the folks at Dungeon Crawl Classics are also hip to that vibe. So good for you guys. Dungeon Crawl Classics.
Living Games. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, we need to talk to the Astrogalomancer for our next episode. So,
oh, boy.
Summon him forth.
Yeah. Oh.
All right.
The clickety-clackety math rocks. The Astrogalomancer gazes into the dice. And he sees, of all things, the amazing new phenom of video games, Helldivers. Wow.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
who saw that coming? Okay, this is not like one of your AAA rating, you know, super companies that like the mega yacht crowd.
Mm.
This is not your EA and such. No. This, what was it, Arrowhead?
Yeah, Arrowhead Studios.
Arrowhead Studios delivered the monster surprise hit of all time. Wow, the ambush just shows up, well-priced, and terrific graphics and gameplay. The only thing they didn't have is, like, they could not have guessed that the entire planet would flock to them instantaneously and flood their servers. That is how popular Helldivers has become. We're going to talk about the game, the phenom, and, of course, the background, the history, the lore inside it, and so on.
Which gives nods to one of our more controversial takes on Robert Heinlein's main, his big splash in the pond, which was Starship Troopers. I mean, hey, no offense to anybody, a stranger in a strange land. But Helldivers owes so much to Starship Troopers, we can't even begin to talk about it in this very limited episode without getting off into a ramble.
Yeah, there will be a number of like critical source material and influential things that we will discuss as components that have led to kind of the creation of this atmosphere that Helldivers has brought to life in video game.
Yeah, that Starship Troopers is selling on bestseller lists again. That's incredible. But hey, you know, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk a little bit about Robert Heinlein and how some people are just missing the point.
A little whiff of Warhammer 40K, you know, tied in. Because, I mean, that too.
So it's going to be another topical discussion like this that may not be crunchy on the game lore, but it will be fluffy on the content, as much as I hate to use those words. But I find that there's a few ways to be more succinct.
But there are a couple of highly, you know, relevant things. I mean, there's going to be a brief discussion, including the, you know, what were the components that went into creating a mega hit that came out of nowhere, like it right out of left field. What are the elements that made this the super hit that it is?
Well, I think also, all right, well, we've got a little bit of time. One of the things we wanted to give a peek at is like how differently, now I'm pretty sure maybe 10 years down the road, the CEO will become completely a yacht owner and a, you know, like, you let the plebeians, you know, play on the free to play servers. We have downloadable content to sell, boys. yeah, when he's that way, then, you know, we know that they've sold out. But right now, some of the content, like, hey, people are pressuring them to get, we want PvP. And like, nope, we're not going to do PvP. This is a cooperative game. The story element and all the lore support you working as a unit, a team of cohesive freedom fighters, bringing democracy and freedom to the bugs and the automatons. So yes, you are delivering your level 3 democracy bringer is going to be bringing for great justice to the bugs. Now, that in tones that, yes, you then they would turn into another Call of Duty clone where just people are like, I'm going to sit here at the tunnel and snipe everybody who comes through and drop a grenade if I get hurt. Yeah. And take us both out.
Yeah.
Yeah, nope, you're not going to have that player. He's going to be harnessed. That player, look.
Your performance is entirely based on being of value to your own team. Tough break. Like, obviously, this is not the game for you. If the only thing you wanted to do was come here and torture your fellow players.
And grief. Yep.
Yeah.
You're going to get kicked.
This is not your game.
They're like, what? You're not letting us play the game the way we want to play it.
Yeah. Like, we just brought up one of the elements that made a super hit. Okay. You're like, what was the world crying out for that people did not realize it was crying out for? Oh, wow. A game with a, like, actual positive team goal mentality. Wow, who would have expected that to be a huge hit in a world where everybody is literally sick to the point of vomiting from griefers and crap hounds that, like, just make every, you know, MMORPG or massive multiplayer game, they make it into a just a sludge heap that you have to crawl through in order to find a few diamonds. Yeah. These people designed it right. And
that's it. And don't worry, we'll cover that. But
they got some other tidbits that we'll
cover that as well. But yeah, the griefing element. Can we just set aside the things that divide us and just come together to crush bugs and angry robots?
Sure. Yeah, the best times I ever had playing StarCraft were not, you know, like, I had some enjoyable moments in the early days of StarCraft playing against people, except South Koreans, because it was not really playing against them. It was more like enjoying being slaughtered in, like, 1.5 minutes.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was just like, how?
Macros and hotkeys.
Yeah, that is the finest use of macros and hotkeys I have ever seen. I got destroyed. But the fun that I had was putting a team together in, like, built scenarios where it was Starship Trooper style. And all you got to do, like, hold out 20 minutes against a tidal wave. That was great. I had a blast. It was all teamwork based. So,
yeah,
good times.
I think that's a good place to end it right there.
So. Yeah.
All right, so as promised, our content, anime, manga, and the gamer, a love story, or a Venn diagram really badly drawn. You decide. That's going to be coming up next, so stick around. And welcome back. So yeah, here we are with topics. So anime, manga, and the gamer, a love story. Yeah, we may seem like in this episode we're earning our weeb wings, which... Well, hey, I am probably one of the most anti-anime fans out there who actually enjoys quite a bit of anime. I've had to have a copy of Princess Mononoke shoved into my hands and literally had to be dragged, kicking and screaming, to the flat screen to watch it. And afterwards, like, hey, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah, I was filled with contempt. You know, quite the opposite. I am now a fan. But once upon a time, I treated everything except Star Blazers. Like, I had this one glorious memory of a good show, and I eschewed and despised everything else. Mm-hmm. I just had this glowering contempt for the entire genre and everyone who liked it. And then I ran across a couple of shows that, like, broke the mold. The first time I watched
Vampire Hunter D, I read Bastard. Which, well, okay, apologies to anybody who's familiar with Bastard, the manga, but yeah. Yeah, I got into a little bit of it. I mean, I touched briefly on it, but Bastard really hits all the things, heavy metal, fantasy, gaming. Yeah, that's, it's like somebody specifically wrote this for me, and then I eschewed it for so long.
For me, it was Cowboy Bebop.
Cowboy Bebop has Lupin III.
Yeah, you know, I had not realized the inheritance relationship of the noir classic that Lupin the Third had.
Yeah, before we get too far out.
Yeah, we've already strayed into too much turf, but these were the things that we encountered that made us stop and reconsider, that made the guys who, frankly, we were both like, yeah, screw that. There's nothing there for me. There's no reason for me to like even notice this.
But Starblazers was cool.
Yeah, I remember that as a kid, and you know it was okay. But the rest of this is crap. And then you had like the thing that like you saw as a kid, and you went, oh, that was pretty cool. But the rest of this is crap. We eventually changed. Okay, the times changed, and while we might still be a little picky and selective about what we watch,
more opinionated and overly controversial about it,
the phenom of this spread from the time of our childhood.
And it's a topic we want to talk about here. How did that happen? How did we get exposed to this stuff? How did I learn about Bastard the manga? How did I learn about like Captain Harlock? Like, if you really enjoyed Starblazers, you're going to enjoy Captain Harlock. Like, really? Yeah, it's the same guy. Just this was a character that was going to be introduced at the last part of the first season as Wildfire's brother was going to come and save him. You know, this mysterious battleship had been showing up with a skull and crossbones at the front. And I was like, oh, if only I knew.
Yeah.
If only I knew that was where it came from. But then later, like, hey, this is pretty similar to Star Blazers, you know? Dweeb and not weeb. It's just like I was stumbling into this stuff. So, yeah, we have to start all the way back. Like everything, we're going to have a discussion. So the first incarnations of anime actually didn't happen without manga, which was the cartoon medium, the pulp medium that was post-war Japan's entry into like a form of entertainment that was affordable to most people.
Yeah, the object of it being that... it was accessible, okay? And accessibility was a big component in its success. These little visual art, graphic novel-esque ways to tell stories, it combined, obviously, the story writing facet, the, you know, like background plot, characters, you know, the compelling narrative, all of that.
Yeah.
But then it had the visual element combined.
But the initial opener, which everybody talks about, so we're just going to briefly say, because it is so so powerful of a touchstone. Astro Boy was a retelling of Pinocchio with a bit of Superman. And, you know, it got reflected all the way through to Ultraman live action stuff. And, look.
But in its infancy, you know, here was just a fun little story that, you know, it riffed on a couple of core concepts and, you know, fused them.
Yeah, and that was the thing. It's like, who would have thought to make, like, a Pinocchio story with a robot? I mean, it seems natural, but why hadn't people done it before? And maybe they had, but this was a unique take on it that also combined him with superpowers. Just not like, okay, he's a boy trying to be human, or a construct trying to be a human, but he's also a boy trying to be a man. And then, you know, now he is also entrusted with great responsibility.
Yeah.
Built to solve problems.
A cute little narrative. Now, that's one of your first mega hits. Its popularity paved the way for all the things that came after. Fascinatingly, the rise of manga being developed into cartoon properties, into animated properties, that was normal in, you know, Japan. It was not uncommon for the popularity of a manga decides whether something is going to be developed into another medium. Quite the opposite in the United States. Very late in the game, as these properties were emerging, only if it had already filtered its way through the manga existence into the anime existence, into the exportable anime existence.
Yeah, and thanks then to guys like Sandy that. Frank, we had G-Force, Speed Racer.
Yeah.
And, but they had been established in Japan long before, like Gatchaman and Speed Racer. But Speed Racer...
That's hit number two here.
Okay, you know, was a big one. But and in America, they were called cartoons.
Yeah.
Well, Japan to and it was seen as just like with comics, they don't call them comics, they call them manga, and then to elevate them further in people's eyes, you know, we see the guy, the store owner from the Android's Dungeon. They're not comic books, they're manga. You got to learn the difference, or you're going to have to leave the store.
ultimate gatekeeper moment.
Yeah. Just so like
you cannot enjoy anything except on the terms that I permit you. Go die.
Right. Yeah. It turns out that he is the villain.
He's absolutely the villain
of his own narrative. He's become the villain now. He's crossed that line, his Rubicon. So, yeah, it's called anime, but we call it cartoons. It doesn't really matter. We've used them interchangeably. That means that they're beloved. Look, I've had a lot of fun in animation. Like, we had a big explosion in the 80s and 90s. Late 80s, 90s, I should say. And that was due to the influence of anime. And now there's a whole American genre dedicated to it. You have, like, Critical Role and Harlequin are all animated features that are told very with sophisticated storylines and adult language that are sometimes for laugh and sometimes for drama and effect. Had Venture Brothers and what's the show? Archer. Yeah, yeah, wrap up their seasons, and they were a mixed bag of that, but always with love to their sources. And I think that's the big thing, is that when we look at these things, and we took a brief turn here, but we're back on the road now.
Well, yeah, we got Futurama and, of course, The Simpsons and things like this. The rise that of were animated more entertainment has also paralleled with the rise of anime. Now, a fascinating moment of the intersection for American gamers and nerds is that it was, frankly, I attribute the legacy of anime developing popularity and saleability in the United States nearly exclusively to gamers, to nerds, okay? These hardcore science fiction fantasy nerds who go to cons and like rattle dice at tables, those are the people that basically carried the torch for this. And
whether you knew it or not, by liking Star Blazers and you were adjacent to Star Trek, like, you kind of seen some, the obvious homages to Star Trek, a multinational, diverse crew.
So you meet another gamer, and they're like, oh, well, yeah, I liked that too.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of Star Trek in a certain way.
I've heard of this, insert rarefied product that almost nobody can find in the United States. Yeah. And it passed verbally, okay? It passed virally from, you know, nerd to nerd, gamer to gamer. This is how, like, the desire slowly built. Because if there's no market for a thing and nobody's heard of it, then there's no point in it even coming over and trying to sell. Like, it just was a non-starter. Yeah. But that slow burn, that almost, like, unplanned, holistic viral marketing, the desire keeps spreading, and instead of, like, well, there's only one person in a city of 10,000 people who would even be interested in this. And then it became two. And then it became four. And eight. And 16. And pretty soon you're cutting off somebody's head because that's all the rice in the kingdom.
But
if you get that joke, you are a winner.
But that's also due to adjacent venues. And I want to, if I can take a moment to walk off in the weeds again.
Yeah.
But keep a rope on me. Bring me back if I start to stray. The adjacent venues for early gamers were the comic store. You would say, yeah, that's pretty normal. But there was also the hobby store, which has kind of fallen by the wayside. They still exist, but they rarely deal with games anymore. But back in the day, the hobby store where you bought model trains and airplanes and ships and stuff like that, you also had role-playing games. They often carried role-playing games because that was seen. Wargaming was a hobby that was adjacent to model building.
Yes.
You build tanks and planes. You want to maybe, you know, play Third Reich or Tunisia or whatever. You're going to play these war games and they would interest you. So there. But role-playing games came into it. And that's primarily my main exposure. We had the Hobby House up on Territorial up in here.
Oh, my gosh.
And yes, they had that huge collection of D&D stuff. And I went in there, first time seeing all those painted miniatures. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is what I got to get.
It was pretty cool.
And
I saw the books and I was like, these are the weirdest things I've ever seen.
Yep.
I must have this.
Get involved in it. So there's all that adjacent stuff. But The hobby shop never really got into manga, so that's why. But when the hobby house moved, and then they just didn't want, oh, we don't have to deal with those weird role player crap anymore. Oh, yeah, they'll screw you. So I had to go across the town to BookQuest.
The angry old bearded road apples. You
just... And then I met Fred Reebok, and of course he's passed, but he ran with his fiance. They ran a great business. Bookshelves, old used books, comics, and strange stuff from Japan, because he used to go to Detroit and get rarefied stuff. And that's where I first started to see. He was the one who showed me Captain Harlock. Well, you like Star Blazers? Here, try. You might want to try some Captain Harlock in the Arcadia. And I'm like, the Arcadia, I miss you. Why won't you visit me, Arcadia? You know, picking up individualists, broken souls, and strays. And that's who his crew is.
Yep.
And he's like Peter Pan with it, but he's so stoic. No emotion.
Which, also a characteristic.
Yeah, it's the whole thing. But yeah, so I didn't know about that. But again, once I got involved with other comics, and I was also a comics fan, but I just didn't make that jump right away. I was very tied into X-Men and a lot of the popular comics of the day.
Well, and I'm going to...
Now I'm back on the road, so continue on.
I'm going to reference something that, like, if this is as close to controversial as we will get here.
Okay.
The thing that impacted negatively, that caused us to be resistant to it, is that, you know, there is a light side and a dark side to anime and manga. And the dark side, you know, was basically people immediately noticed one of two things. Either they were into something that was like an action story, or like a dramatic story that really like touched on genres, you know, some of the high tech and futuristic and science fiction and all of that, just really great stuff that I think it automatically connected to gamers. But because this was also an era of like people in adolescence or late adolescence, there was also the sexy stuff, which you like came in a brown paper wrapper. And if you noticed how sweaty bombed the fan base was for this stuff, it grossed you out. You're like, yeah, I'm super uncomfortable with this. Like, I'm not, like, I don't feel like I'm in a good place with this. Mm-mm. So I'm going to back away. And that diminished my opinion, like just watching people who, they had really gone down the dark path very quickly. Like, I mean, it was not like they had to be coaxed. It was more or less like a pearl diver, and they just pew, off the cliff.
Look, I don't mind some cheesecake here and there, and that's what I thought. But when I picked up a copy of Dragon Pink, I was quite, I'm like, oh, I'm afraid to be have this in my house, because if there's ever an investigation after a strange death, I don't want anybody making any connections with this.
So. Yeah. So the dark side of anime and manga in the United States was that, like, you know, this is another country's mores and concepts and ideas, and it inevitably created a conflict between the fan base and everybody else.
Yeah, I wanted to see Record of the Lodoss War. I don't mind a couple other things. Like, and Bastard was definitely cringy AF, but you know what? By that time, I was well into it. Look, let's get back on to the main
part. I went straight to Cowboy Bebop.
Which sure, you did, but in. Also at the early 80s stuff, right adjacent to that, we're going to talk about Battletech.
And now, yeah, can you even, it's almost impossible to reference something more powerfully influential to gamers than Robotech, G-Force, and...
Yeah, Battletech. Macross, Robotech, everybody's pretty familiar with. But before that, there was Crusher Joe, Fang of the Sun, Dogrum. And I hate to be the owner of the Android dungeon and say, like, well, there was actually one before that. But yeah, you know, the Shadow Hawk and Griffin come from Crusher Joe. Fang of the Sun had the Crusader and a couple other models that weren't available. But Macross had, like, the Warhammer, Excalibur, Marauders. Look, the classic battle mechs that we would come to enjoy of the Battletech game were completely taken from these animes. And everybody loved Macross and Robotech, so they thought, hey, you know, we're just going to borrow their designs. And actually, FASA did go out and attempt to get a hold of the copyright owners.
Yes.
But the guy who actually held them was a scam artist. And he's like, yeah, I've got the exclusive distribution rights in America for these shows. And he actually convinced people. Now, later when he was brought to court, he just actually bought them as a cure-all, and that solved all the media problems. But it left FAFSA out, dangling out, like, hey, we made some attempts to try to get the rights to these. No, you didn't contact a legitimate source, and you got to drop them. So, look, BattleTech was a direct formation of, like, if you saw, like, the cover, which has the Warhammer, in Macross, it's called the Excalibur, and it's a completely different vehicle, but yeah, it's primarily a land attack mode versus the transforming robots or fighter planes like what would be the Wasp, Phoenix Hawk, and Stinger mechs in BattleTech. Crusher Joe, of course, had the Shadow Hawk Griffin. There were just two sides of it, and it's a different, it was a shorter lived manga. Yeah. And then later an anime that was just one or two episodes, I think. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm just covering them so that the BattleTech fans out there understand what I'm talking about. When I'm like, yeah, there was something before Robotech, okay? Oh, yeah. They didn't steal everything from
Robotech. Again, it was one of those things that started small in isolated places. It had a certain popularity. Others experimented in the same little sub-mini genre. And then it began to expand outward. It was a concept that people connected to.
And they
to,
called it, so in Japan, they started to call it Mecha. They called it Mecha, and later would lead to its own genre. But adjacent to it, in almost an isolation, American gaming fostered its own Mecha fandom outside, just with the barest of influence. It's like, you didn't need to know anything about Crusher Joe or Dogrum to understand that, like, hey, why do we love the Phoenix and Battle Hawk? Or Phoenix Hawk and Shadow Hawk so much? Because they come, they're the really cool looking designs. It's got the cannon on the shoulder. It's carrying a big gun and it transforms into a fighter plane like an F-14. Who doesn't love that stuff, right?
I can only get just so erect. But just the Krieger moment there.
Archer.
It was destined to be a hit.
Okay. And it developed in outside of anything to do with the source material. They just basically saw it for most BattleTech fans, they just saw these designs. They recognized them from posters hanging up on the wall of their local gaming comic shops. And they said, hey, you know what? There's Robotech. And yeah, there was a Robotech role-playing game and a game from Palladium. It's still going today. And say what you want about the Robotech series where it wandered off to, there's still Gundam. You know, which was definitely encapsulated a lot of the model diorama builders as well as just the manga and anime fans. But that one started as a franchise from the ground up, which, you know, we could have a whole side conversation. So I'm just walling that off right there.
And it's also important to remember that gaming, both by use of computer and otherwise, had a significant presence.
Final Fantasy.
Yeah, coming out of the Japanese market and going into the Japanese market. It's a two-way street. And as the popularity of gaming and RPGs rose, you began to see a lot of like lesser-known RPG-type games became popular overseas, and correspondingly, manga also has entire genres like the isekai, which is like transported to another world. You know, it's just a simple theme. And gamer tropes are very popular in the isekai thing. You're like, oh man, I got trapped in the fantasy game that I was supposed to be playing. A very Tron-esque, or if we're familiar with like an American fantasy fiction version of isekai, would be the Sleeping Dragon, where the players
or Guardians of the Flame series.
Yeah, they wind up trapped in the world in which they had been playing their game. So this is, you know, like intersectional here. Like these genres and these experiences have.
Now the orc girlfriend is a whole romance literature and manga, as I understand.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No. My wife's been reading a couple of them, and she's been on Book Talk telling me that that also applies to mangas. I was talking about what I was planning for this episode. And she's like, yeah, it's a whole thing, you know, like having an orc or goblin girlfriend is, you know, a whole romance.
Well, obviously not a Pathfinder goblin. Like, oh man, the dog's dead and everything's on fire. Cripes.
And now she's
worst poisoned. Girlfriend ever.
Well.
And she stole all my dice.
She ate them. Yeah, so it's, if you're ever familiar with Goblin Mode, you know what we're talking about. So, yeah, there's a cross-sectional back and forth now that wasn't there in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it only was there for the struggles of the 90s. 90s is a varied time, and I would like to just brush past it because there's a lot of unpleasantness.
Oh, my
That's
God.
When I went like, hey, I write liked Record of the Lodoss War. Oh, here's a, right next to it, Dragon Pink. Oh, okay, this will probably be a little cutesy TNA and a
open.
Oh my God, what the, I did not know. I did not need that in my life.
Fisherman's Wife and Fisherman's Wife 2, the retelling.
And when you see that, you're kind of like, okay, I don't want to go back to it. And then, you know, I'm like, people are like, hey, why isn't there a fantasy adaptation or anime version of Bastard? Well, yeah. It would probably be banned in several states right off the bat.
Yeah.
It's not something, it's, yeah. Look, they completely went off the rails after the first 10 issues. I was like, yeah, I don't need this either. And I don't understand why it always goes to the places it does. But, you know, creativity is what it is. And we also have to mention Ghost in the Shell for the cyberpunk.
Masterpiece.
It's still well, considered. Before that even, excuse me, I got ahead of myself. Akira.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So Akira was a lovingly drawn manga, and it was treated very reverently by the animation studios that took on the task. They knew that it was going to be monumental, and animators rose from across the country and even from the world to come and join in drawing this project.
Yeah.
And it created a masterstroke of like where people start saying, hey, these just aren't little dopey cartoons. There's some serious storytelling involved here and world building.
Not to mention directorially and artistically, it was at the moment of Akira's nascent rise to fame. That was kind of the Rubicon moment where like people crossed that line. We went, this was art. This was science fiction. This was, you know, drama. This was artistically superior and directorially excellent. It delivered something that I had not seen before, and it did it well. And people took notice. And I think that might have been like the moment you heard that straw break the camel's back, or like the resistance that people had to anime products and manga as a valid genre crumbled.
Mm-hmm.
In the face of that masterpiece. And like then, of course, you get Ghost in the Shell and things like that.
But Akira is just as influential to cyberpunk fans as Blade Runner.
Yeah.
And that's a telling point there. Now, also Ghost in the Shell, which also has its TNA TZ moments.
Sure.
But I feel that in spite of that.
But in the case of Ghost in the Shell, you know, like it was a more restrained.
Okay. Yeah, it did.
It never overshadowed the more important discussion that was taking.
Sure. And what it was to be human, what it was to even be sentient.
Yeah.
There's a lot of deep discussion in it. And just like with Lone Wolf and Cub, they cover almost every part of society that exists in that imaginary world, which they did a really good job, I think, of world building in that one as well. Well, it was mostly a solo work. But then the video games that spawned out of those, as well as the marketing merchandise. I mean, you can still see Major Kusanagi statues in comic shops. There's a lot of pinup art of her. Yeah, all over the place. And of course, we just had the recent movie. But nonetheless, that is how influential and wide mainstream it became, especially adjacent to The Matrix and other things that helped build up the cyberpunk genre and to help define it. And I think that really speaks of how influential the media was of cyberpunk. A Midwestern dude writes a novel about a guy brain hacking or brain burning through AI software. And this resonates throughout all other mediums.
Yeah, that the hip folks, the lit crowd, all over the world brushed up against this thing, and everybody took it on a ride. Like, everybody brought their own something to that experience after reading Neuromancer. And the offshoot of that has been 1,000 things that we've really enjoyed.
Yeah, and
some of which I never saw coming, but, you know, like others, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, Buto is typically your street samurai solo template character, and you just can't escape the fact that if you're in the cyberpunk genre, you're going to run across Ghost in the Shell or Akira at some point in time, just like with Blade Runner. So,
well, and for me, yeah, it's always Cowboy Bebop.
I'm right, and of course, we were talking about
Shinichiro Watanabe and you know, some of the other products from that group developed things like Samurai Champloo, or I think they were involved in Black Lagoon. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Black Lagoon's another great one.
Yeah, this is all stuff that comes later, but all of it traces back to that nascent rise amongst our
the dark culture. Times of the 90s went into the aughts, and that's when it got better. We had more imports, Big O, Adult Swim.
Oh, thank you, Adult Swim.
Yeah, they brought and exposed a whole new generation and just widened the depth of the pool so we could get
they
into...
They really culled some of the best. They okay, did. Now, and look, now, Trigun, of course, people love, like, the...
Helsing, yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that encounter the anime that are really made for children. The Dragon Ball Z's and Naruto's and things like that. Those are like kids shows that remain popular with people even into adulthood. But they never would have gotten a chance to shine if it had not been for the perseverance of gamer fans. Not even me. I can't, like, we can't take that credit.
Nope.
That belongs to the people who carried the torch for the best products out of animation and manga. They carried that torch for years. And just were cool enough to, like, hey, well, if you dug that, you should check out this. And they did that noble deed for almost, two decades?
Yep.
Unrewarded. And here we are.
Yep, and we are much richer for it. So, yeah, we could talk about Helsing and Vampire Hunter D for the vampire crowd and
Gosh.
We're running low on time, and I think we've definitely beat the subject to death and abused your eardrums long enough. So we're going to call it in here and wrap it up. So I think that was pretty good. How do you feel about it?
I feel like we did a solid.
All right. Until next time, then. May the dice always roll in your favor.
We're out.
See ya.